You know, for somebody of my training, I'm not a scientist, not a policy person, not an economist, not even a philosopher, just a humble historian, as they say in Australia. To be talking about global warming is to always invite trouble. I was in Berlin recently speaking to a group of scientists and engineers and policy people. A big crowd, but that's what they were. Giving a very short 15-minute version of what I'm going to talk about today. And one insistent question people kept asking me, so what are your practical suggestions? And I said, look, you know, I work at the University of Chicago. And when I was recruited, I was told that in Chicago we don't work on anything that's either fashionable or useful. So I'll begin by explaining why I got interested in the question of global warming. I mean, globalization, of course, people have been interested in for some time. And I got interested in the topic of climate change for several reasons. One was that, as a historian, it was clear to me that this crisis is one of the most important turning points in human history. While historians have been slow to respond to the debates about the crisis, the scientific discussions pointed up to me not only the shortfalls of post-colonial or democratic theory, which is what I would normally take an interest in, but showed how much of this theory is environmentally blind as well. In fact, Tim Mitchell from Columbia has recently argued in a paper that almost all theories of democracy take the idea of unlimited growth for granted. It was also arresting to observe that while we live now under two different, the cross pressures, as Charles Taylor calls them, of two different discourses, one is about globalization, one is about global warming, these two discussions view the human being quite differently. So if you come to look at the contemporary world through discussions of globalization, as not as an economist so much, but as a cultural studies person or a historian or a literature person, the idea that actually dominates the discussion is that of historical and cultural differences, or what some people call anthropological differences. In other words, that's why globalization leads to the talk about cosmopolitanism, toleration, multiculturalism, cultural pluralism, how do I live with somebody who is different, all those kind of questions. So globalization emphasizes how we are different. Whereas if you read scientists on global warming, they actually look at human beings as already constituting a kind of collectivity. Sometimes they would say a species, whose collective impact on the planet is they're studying. So in a way, in globalization discussion, you have to go through differences. In global warming discussions, we are already one. But what was really striking for me as a historian was to notice that that the climate scientists were telling a story and commenting on human activity of the past 250 years, particularly scientists who were saying, and which is now accepted, that global warming is anthropogenic in nature, that it's actually not caused by natural factors, but by what we human beings have done, was that they were telling a kind of human history. In other words, normally somebody of my background would not be interested in history of climate. You know, if you go to the library, there are tons of books on histories of climate, you know, in the last, I don't know, over the millennia. And normally we don't read them because there are no human beings in those stories. But now they're telling a history of the climate from which the role of human beings cannot be separated. So as somebody who does human history, I realized that it was impossible to talk about this story without putting human beings at the center of it. And in that sense, again, I felt, as somebody who is interested in what human beings do, this is my topic. And finally, there's a bit of my own Indian background which comes into forming this interest, which is that, you know, for those of you who study India or know a little bit about South Asia would know that the subcontinent has had a very long tradition of thinking about what constitutes enjoyment. and it's a particular branch of studies, rhetoric. And Indian theorists, of course, developed this idea of rasa, like a juice-like property that constitutes, that's kind of released in your body as you enjoy something. Almost something that describes mood in these juicy terms. And there are nine of them, they say. Some people say seven, some say nine. And like anger, calmness, grotesqueness, all these humor. And I always thought that European rule, colonialism gave us the sense for a tenth rasa, which is the rasa of irony. And for me, the major rasa for doing history, the major sense of enjoyment I have personally in writing history, thinking about history, is that of irony. In other words, as a historian, what always interests me is the shadow that necessarily falls between the promise and the performance. So if you think about, I mean, for me, global warming is the shadow that falls on the promise of civilization and its performance in the last 200 years. So it's interesting to think that the entire period that we have kind of celebrated as that of civilization, that of the pinnacle of human civilization or freedom or modernity, actually is the period that has caused unintentionally this phenomenon of global warming. So spurred on by these thoughts, I actually took a first step and published an essay earlier this year in Critical Inquiry in the winter issue, which I called The Climate of History. I'm just trying to remember what I called it. Four Theses. And assuming that most of you haven't seen the essay, I'll just quickly tell you what my theses were, if you can remember them. What I do in the rest of the talk is actually speak to the fourth thesis, so which is the more critical one, but just to tell you what I said, whether I said them in the form of thesis. My first thesis as a historian was to say that anthropogenic theories of climate change spell the collapse of the humanist distinction between natural history and human history. I mean, in other words, if you can't separate human beings from the causes of global warming, it's global. If human agency is at the center of this natural environmental crisis, then you have actually collapsed the distinction between human history and natural history, even in more challenging ways than environmental histories, one could argue, have done so far. My second thesis was that the idea, geologists have been saying that, you know, the geological period called Holocene, which is the recent period since the invention of, or the discovery or whatever, of agriculture, last 10 to 4,000 years, 14,000 years. And some of them, climate scientists now say that that Holocene has ended. And there's been the beginning of a new geological period in which human beings play the role of a geological force. The climate of this planet has normally been decided by forces that operate on a huge scale, on vast planetary geological scales. And to realize that human beings now work as one of these planetary forces is to recognize, they're saying, that a new geological period has started, which they're calling the Anthropocene. Then my second thesis was that the idea of the Anthropocene severely qualifies human histories, humanist histories of modernization or globalization. My third thesis then was that the geological hypothesis regarding the Anthropocene requires us to put global history of capital in conversation with the species history of humans. In other words, I'm trying generally to develop the argument that if we really want to grapple with climate change, then the narrative of the story of capitalism is necessary but not sufficient. And that's mainly my gripe as in this essay and perhaps in that other essay too, with my usual friends on the left. So I was trying to argue that one has to put these two things together, and the problem of putting them together is what I'm going to address in tonight's lecture. So my fourth thesis was that if you try to put these things together, our history as a species, what I call species history, and the history of capital, my fourth thesis was that if you try to put them together, it becomes a process of probing the limits of historical understanding. And I use historical understanding in a very specific sense, which is something I will explain as I go on. So it's really the fourth thesis that trying to combine in our heads history of capitalism and what I call species history put stress on how we understand the very idea of historical understanding. So the familiar story of capital and the story that goes with it, which is a kind of West versus the rest story, that the West became imperialist and dominated other people, that story in different ways underlies a lot of political discussions of climate change today. So what I'm saying is that if you listen to the debates about climate change leading up to the conference in Copenhagen in a few weeks, you will find, in my terms as a historian, that there is almost a historiographical debate going on. Now, obviously, scientists won't say they're writing history or they're doing historiographical debate. I'm saying this, that there's a historiographical debate. One debate looks on the story of climate change in terms of a short-term history, a few hundred years. And another debate looks on the question of climate change in terms of much longer history. And that's my The Long and the Short of Human History in the title of this talk. So there's a position now in climate change debate called the climate justice position. It's generally called the climate justice position, which says that the Western countries have actually done most of the damage, and therefore it's their responsibility to clean it up. And some people in India and China have argued, though the Indian debate is becoming more complicated and the Chinese one too, that China and India won't even do anything until the Western countries actually do certain things, so that their participation should be conditional on this. And this position is broadly called the climate justice position. Recently in June, the United Nations published their annual volume, which is called Promoting Development and Saving the Planet, published in June 2009. And it puts forward, it was very welcomed both in China and India, this report. And it was actually signed off by the Undersecretary of United Nations, the Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, a Chinese national called Mr. Sha Zhukung. And the debate and this volume, Big Tech volume, begins with a preface written by Mr. Sha Zhukung, where he says the climate crisis, and I'm quoting, "The climate crisis is the result of the very uneven pattern of economic development that evolved over the past two centuries, which allowed today's rich countries to attain their current levels of income, in part through not having to account for the environmental damage now threatening the lives and livelihoods of others." So characterizing climate change as a developmental challenge, I mean, it's almost sort of mode of thinking where climate change takes second place to economic thinking, the question of development. So they take climate change on this position, in this position of climate justice, as a developmental challenge. Sha Zhukung goes on to remark how a certain deficit of trust marks the attitude of the non-Western countries towards the West. And the report actually expands on this point. Within the report, the authors say, government leaders in many developing countries are concerned that climate change is being used by those at the top of the development ladder and who gorged excessively on global carbon budget to get there, to again constrain. It's very interesting. So the sentence actually assumes that we know when it happened for the first time. To again constrain the efforts of these countries to climb higher. And so the first time was, of course, colonialism. And the second time is again, this is happening. How developing countries can achieve catch-up growth and economic convergence. This is something I'll come back to, the whole idea of catch-up growth and economic convergence. In a carbon-constrained world, and what advanced countries must do to relieve these concerns have become leading questions for policymakers at the national and international levels. Now, this is, just a crude summary of the climate justice position. The problem is, of course, that, as you can see, this is a position in which the West is seen as necessarily predatory, and obviously there's justification in historical experience of this. Even statistics are seen as partisan. There's been statements by Indian scientists saying, we will produce statistics that the Western scientists won't be able to challenge, as if, and statistics, I suppose, are always partisan. And this is a position where they see that all the talk about humanity, like species, humanity, is actually a ruse for covering up the West. You know, West humanity is an excuse for actually not talking about what the West has done. So that's why Xia Zhukung eventually says climate change is the result of the very uneven pattern of economic development of the last 200 years. Now, while there is much historical reason and understandable reasoning that is there in this position, the position is also actually more complicated. The position is not more complicated, but it needs to be more complicated than it is. Because if you think about it, the climate change is the result of the very uneven pattern of economic development in the last 200 years. You can see that, I mean, forget the fact that development is never even. I mean, development is always uneven. But if we imagine for a moment, what would have happened if you ask the question, if development were even? If everybody were equally prosperous on this planet, but we had made the same technological and economic choices, the climate change crisis would have been worse, because we would have put out even more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. What saves us, ironically, and this is my 10th rasa, is the fact, the sad fact, that most people are poor. And the poor don't emit very much. So in a way, it's problematic to say that an even development process would have somehow given us a better situation with respect to the climate. And there's also the interesting fact that when people talk about per capita emissions, which is what is often trotted out, the per capita emissions, those statistics hide a very interesting history of actually demography and population growth. And the interesting fact about population growth in India and China is that after the war, that's where the population has really grown and that's where the population is projected to grow. Most countries that actually became intensely capitalist, as you know, saw their population growth rates dipping. Sometimes they've had negative population growth, which is why they depend on immigration and people moving in. Whereas both India and China actually developed. Their population just grew. I mean, Indian population in my lifetime has grown more than 3 times. And population growth obviously has had something to do with modernization, something to do with improvement in life chances, but not necessarily to do with capitalism. China was not capitalist when population grew. And in fact, if one did a history of family planning in both India and China, you would find that there was a lot of opposition to the very idea of family planning in the 1950s and 60s, and even into the 70s. If you think of Mahmud Mamdani's book, which was much celebrated in 1973, or looking at population explosion in Punjab villages, the argument always was that population was not the right issue. The right issue was social inequality. Growing up in India, we had a text that we had to read called We Plan for Prosperity, in which we were always told that population is a resource. And the West wants us to forget that. Again, this business of the West is again trying to inhibit us. And we were told that the West does not want us to grow, and therefore they want us to do family planning so that we remain weak and underdeveloped and don't have this economic resource. And then, of course, as you know, Chairman Mao's famous statement about atom bomb, when he said that Americans were paper tigers. He also said that there were so many Chinese that even if the Americans dropped a few atom bombs, you know, they wouldn't be able to kill them all. So if you actually go back and look at the history of population, then you'd find that just as philosophers talk about past polluters, prospective polluters, and retrospective polluters, the West have been past polluters, China and India will be the future polluters, you can also talk about past populators. And the question is, it can't be blamed on capitalism. Nobody held a gun to Indians' heads and said populate or copulate. But actually, copulate is the wrong term because, you know, all the demographic statistics actually show that coital frequencies are higher in the West. But ours was more effective. So anyway, all I can say is that the population versus the pollution story is more complicated than the climate justice position would indicate. So that's why I'm saying that the story of capital, in fact, if you looked at population history from Mars, or Moon these days since Moon has water, it would look like human beings behaved exactly as you would expect a species to behave. The moment the life chances improved, mortality was taken care of by modern medicine, epidemics and famines were gone, our numbers grew. And that's exactly what any species would do if you could create favorable circumstances. So my point is that the story of capital is a necessary part of climate change, of global warming, because A, capital, as I say in my other essay, that it's like the rabbit hole in Alice's story. I mean, that's the hole through which we got into this situation. And B, whatever happens with global warming and climate change will be mediated by the inequalities of capital. There's no question about that. But it's still a necessary but not a sufficient story. But by itself, the narrative does not give us a full perspective on the nature of the crisis. And this is where I think there's a real historiographical divide. In other words, what I'm saying is that a story that only covers a few hundred years, the history of capitalism, history of imperialism, to the time when we will have mitigated climate change and India and China will have grown to a point where billions of Indians and Chinese will have been taken out of poverty, as the argument goes, that few hundred years story has to be kind of placed alongside a much longer story that climate change scientists are talking about. Not that the story is being picked up and actioned on by Western leaders either. But I'm saying there is a kind of historiographical divide. There's a short-term story and there's a long-term story. And in contrast to the short story of climate justice, climate scientists tell a much longer history when it comes to explaining the significance of anthropogenic global warming, and how much longer will be visible from the very subtitle of a recent popular book authored by my colleague, David Archer. David Archer is a professor, he's actually a paleoclimatologist and a very respected scientist who works in the Department of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. And he wrote initially an introductory book on global warming, and this year published a book which has already got a prize called The Long Thaw, and the subtitle tells you the scale on which he is thinking, unlike the climate justice position. The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. So, you know, one history is of a few hundred years, the other history is of 100,000 years. So 100,000 years, if I say to a historian colleague, you know, they would say, is that like the big history that somebody like David Christian talks about? Is that the kind of history we human historians would actually tell? And like a good humanist historian, I'll have to say, you know, the answer is yes and no. Because anything on that scale is obviously big history. But it's not, it's but the magnitude of time involved here takes me back to my fourth thesis, which I proposed in my critical inquiry essay. And I'll just repeat the fourth thesis because that's what I'm homing in on. The cross-hatching of species history or such very long-scale history and the history of capital is a process of probing the limits of historical understanding. Now, I need to explain what I mean by historical understanding, because I'm using it in a very special sense. So just to make a long story short here, when historians normally make a distinction between explanation and understanding. Now, explanation is usually causal connection between events. A causes B, and that's what we call normally explanation. Understanding refers to the more interpretive, hermeneutic side of history, where you understand the past by bringing the past imaginatively within the grasp of your imagination and experience. I mean, Gadamer, in his book Truth and Method, explains it beautifully by saying that history, humanist history, is a kind of self-knowledge, where you begin for your own knowledge of the world as a human being, your own kind of almost phenomenological experience of the human being, and then you extend it to the past. And explanation and understanding have to come together in history. You know, when they don't come together, historians feel unhappy. I mean, a great example of that unhappiness, for instance, is that old 70s book written by two economists, one of whom actually got a Nobel Prize as an economist, Fogel and Engelsman book on the history of slavery, Time on the Cross, which caused a lot of burn among historians like Genovese or Herbert Gutmann, because it was trying to argue that slavery was an efficient, rational mode of production. And the gripe on the part of historians was not to do with that with the point that their maths were wrong. It was more to do with the point that they were missing out on the question of indignity of slavery. And the question of indignity of slavery falls on the side of understanding, because it is how I can imagine myself feeling indignity in the position of a slave. And therefore, I extend that empathy to a person in the past as I write their history. Or if you think of English labor history, There have been debates in the 19th century English table history about explanation and understanding. Big debates about whether the standard of living of the English working classes went up or down in the 19th century, real wages versus, you know, money wages. But that industrial history becomes history only when you place that debate, in which someone like Hobsbawm took part, alongside the very humanist understanding history of E.P. Thompson, where the whole question was not just the standard of wages, but how did people experience working under those sorts of conditions, right? It's always bringing these two things together that make for this marriage of explanation and understanding just to give you another example, when I was teaching in Melbourne, I had a colleague, Stephen Wheatcroft, he was young then, my age, historian of Russia. And he used to have this constant battle going on with a historian called Robert Conquest from Stanford. And the issue was, how many people did actually die in the Soviet Union from famines, from Stalin's effort at collectivization? And I think Robert Conquest had a figure like 12 million, and Steve Wheatcroft had a figure like 8 million. And he'd constantly come to me and say, look, you know, Conquest figures are wrong, he hasn't looked at this census, that, blah, blah, blah. And one day, I mean, I was not a specialist in Soviet history, I said, Steve, what's your problem? Even 1,000 would be bad enough. Why should the Soviet Revolution have 1,000 people being killed at the altar of the revolution? Is that bad for the revolution? Now, I was asking the question about understanding, moral question. And then he explained to me that, look, the figure matters because if so many people died in the famines, then it would be very hard to explain Russian industrialization because you'd have to explain problems in the labor market. Right? So explanation relates to other explanations. Explanation makes sense because it relates to other explanations. So because you can relate explanations, you can actually cognitively manipulate very large figures. You can say, you know, you can have a debate about whether the Aryans came to India 1500 BC or 2000 BC. Now, if you only work with understanding, you would say, what the hell does it matter? You know, like there's a story of an Indian guy taking an American tourist around, and the Indian guy is very proud of Indian heritage and the fact that we're an ancient civilization, and he points to a building and says to his American friend, look, see how ancient our civilization is? That building there is 3,004 years old. And the American says, I understand 3,000, but where do you get this 4 from? You know, I mean, how can you be so precise? And he said, well, it's been 4 years since somebody told me it was 3,000 years old. You know, so... Now, on the axis of understanding, explanation doesn't matter. Explanation matters only if you have other explanations in your head, right? And humanist histories are trying to bring these two things together. So what is the problem then with saying how human beings are changing the climate of the planet for 100,000 years? The problem is that would it matter to me if you said 150,000 years? Would it matter to see if you said 80,000 years and not 100,000 years? I cannot bring it within the realm of my understanding. You see, I mean, I can bring it within explanation. You can explain the carbon cycle of the world. You can explain the rhythm of the glacial period and the interglacial period. But what does it mean to me? On the other hand, when I read somebody like David Archer, he writes with a sense of urgency. You know, one of the most interesting things about reading people like David Archer, people like Wallace Brooker, who is a very well-known climate scientist from Colombia, who actually was the person who talked about the conveyor belts in the sea that affect global temperature. Or, of course, James Lovelock has been there for a very long time, first poo-pooed and now being taken seriously. When you read these climate scientists who are talking on geological scale, what's fascinating in their writing is the sense of urgency with which they speak. I'm now talking about their rhetoric. They actually want us to be able to bring the geological, which is almost works on a sublime scale, into the realm of our affect and ethics. You know, they're saying, act on this world so that the world is a better place for the next 100,000 years. And what I find fascinating as a humanist historian, reading David Archer's books, for instance, that he himself confronts this problem. So I'll just read a little bit from his book. David Archer then begins the very first chapter by saying, even if I ask you to think about 100,000 years, why will you think? Why will you care? So he actually acknowledges that human beings have problems understanding, bringing within their understanding, in that particular sense that I was talking about, bringing with their understanding things that might happen either two generations after them or may have happened two generations before them. And evolutionary biologists often actually make this point that any species, the very logic of survival is such that we are all presentists. You know, the logic of survival says, get rid of the problem in front of you and deal with what comes later. So in a way, survival requires us to be present-focused. Whereas this geologist, through cognition, understand that being just present-focused is not good enough for the problems we face. And therefore, there's this problem that we are, by constitution, present-focused. And they're asking us to be focused on a much larger future that we are, by constitution, not focused on. So Archer actually confronts that problem. And if I can quickly find in the longer version, how he confronts it, it's very interesting. So he begins to say that, look, the rules of economics, and I'm quoting Archer, the rules of economics govern much of our behavior. And they tend to limit our focus to even shorter time frames. Values, I'm quoting Archer, values are related across time using interest rates. A $100 obligation in 100 years might be dealt with by investing $5 today at an inflation-adjusted interest rate of 3% per year. A $100 then cost in 500 years shrinks to 0.003 cents today. Analyzed within the framework of economics, a climate impact 100,000 years from now becomes laughably irrelevant to any rational decision-making. I'm imagining the financial guys on the television listening to me and laughing smugly at how irrelevant it is, ha ha ha. Right? So he is actually imagining that he's going to, you know, the deafness of the years of, because even when economists talk about 50 years, as you know, policy and eventually politicians narrow it down to 5 years if you're lucky. So Archer faces the problem that humans may not actually care for the science he's telling about. 100,000 years is just too far. Why should we care for people so far into the future? And actually, climate scientists, including Archer, often say that even speaking of events like Katrina, that what we are looking at now, because climate change has already happened, what we are looking at now are what they call subtle effects of climate change. So Katrina is actually part of what they call subtle effects. And they say, look, I mean, what is happening now does not give you really an it's not a linear process. It's not going to go up gradually. I mean, as Wallace Brooker says, the climate beast actually kicks. Or as they say, the climate flip-flops. Or sometimes the transitions are very sharp. So therefore, the very idea of caring, which is a question of human ethics, brings into Archer's discussion the problem of what I've called understanding. How do we bring within the fold of our imagination, not just explanation, paths that are truly distant? So Archer then, having imagined the smug financial guys on television laughing him out of court, writes, and yet, I'm quoting him, human cultural memory begins to approach the longevity of our proposed climate adventures. The earliest written records date to 5,500 years ago, and oral traditions may carry some grains of history from earlier still. And so he's appealing to this other faculty we have of memory, using that, and saying, then he says, how would it feel if the Greeks, for instance, had taken advantage of some lucrative business opportunity for a few centuries, aware of potential costs, knowing that this was going to be bad, say a much stormier world or the loss of agricultural productivity to rising sea levels that could persist to this day? So this is an interesting point. You know, on climate justice, many people say, look, what the Western countries did was an unintended effect. People didn't know that this was going to happen. But today, Archer's point is, now that you know, and you have the knowledge that this will have an impact of 100,000 years, or 5,000 years, as he says, how can you do this if you, in other words, would we be able to take pride in our ancient classical Greek heritage if we knew that the Greeks knowingly adopted, did something for which we are paying today? And that's the question he's raising. But he's also asking us, I think, to do the impossible. The geological agency, and here I'm in the last part of my talk, the geological agency that humans have come to acquire for themselves is like the sublime, is really like what Kant calls the sublime. We can use numbers and other operators to bring it within the realm of cognition, but our hardware may be such that we cannot ever grasp it in our understanding. The present crisis of climate change may indeed thus be a crisis of our faculties. In other words, the two faculties of explanation and understanding as I explained them. We face a problem that is of such large proportions that to make it available to human imagination and action, we constantly reduce its time horizon. Economists speak of the effects of climate change at the end of the century. Policymakers reduce it to the next few decades, where even setting emission targets for 2050 seems like a distant goal. So here is the political problem that Archer's analysis suggests. What we do today to affect the climate may have a hugely negative impact on generations that come after our grandchildren are gone. And you know, the Department of Energy has already said that even in 2030, 80% of our energy needs would be met in America by fossil fuels. And if you read the geologists, they're actually saying we can't even afford that if you think of future generations. And increasingly, their scientists are facing the problem. Actually, Andrew Revkin in New York Times, this 23rd September 2009, gives the case of the problem that scientists are facing in explaining or generating a sense of urgency, given that actually in the last 10 years, the temperature hasn't gone up that much. And they quote scientists, several scientists actually, saying that we need something that will have the direct visual or emotive impact of seeing seabirds covered in oil from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So in a way, what I find fascinating is the scientists are actually turning precisely to other forms of creativity that will help bring into the fold of human imagination and understanding what they can approach through the faculty of cognition. And that, it seems to me then, in other words, when we try to imagine a politics adequate to the crisis of climate change, so what I'm saying is that the climate justice position does not give us a politics which is adequate to the science of climate change. The science of climate change gives us a much longer history. Climate justice position talks about the history of imperialism and more or less assumes that there'll be same kind of growth and development in all countries. So it kind of assumes a same charter of growth and assumes that a few hundred years history will do. But when we try to imagine a politics adequate to the crisis of climate change, we then run into the limits of being human. The experience category that is at the heart of Gadamer's exposition of what I call historical understanding refers to the experience of the individual. So one of the interesting problems is that in philosophies of history, this faculty of understanding, how do I understand somebody from the past, is a process whereby I extend my experience as an individual. And if you think of the whole discipline of phenomenology, the unit of explanation in phenomenological theories is the individual. I mean, Heidegger's Dasein is based on the individual as the unit. Whereas if you, and even the Heidegger designs, or think of how in human ontology, the other has always been either gods or ghosts or animals. I mean, late Derrida's meditations on being naked in front of his cat and thinking, you know, how am I a human from the cat's point of view? We've normally thought of the other as god, ghosts, or animals. But what these scientists are talking about, climate scientists brings into view other questions, that of the species, a word actually that's accepted and debated by biologists, and the relationship between organic and inorganic matter in the production of the planet's carbon cycle, and the fact that there can be no phenomenology of the species body as opposed to the individual body, because species has nothing like experience. So there is a blind process of the history of life that's going on, and now you suddenly find, if you think of the modern human, if you think of human beings have always been as a species, and it's not exclusively human, but at least if you think of human beings have as a bunch of animals who have always been concerned about justice in whatever form. I mean, it's very hard to find a point in human history when there's no concern with justice. So if you think of justice as a human project, climate change, this crisis brings us on to some other project, which is the project of this planet, of life, of survival, of species history, which is blind to the question of justice. The technically, the issue of human survival is blind, actually, to the idea of which human survives. And so you're actually, the human project is kind of running up against some other process in this history which we can't completely fold back into questions of human justice. And there are thus limits. For that reason, I think there are limits about what the usual politics of climate change can achieve. For instance, just to give you one example of the limit, one of the things that people are trying to do using market mechanisms is to use price as a behavior regulator. So if you think that if I use the price of fossil fuels, I will not only shift people to other fuels, but I will actually give people an incentive for finding other fuels. So traditional economic theory, price is an incentive for finding substitutes. Now, with climate change, if the oceans are a sink for CO2, you can't use price to find a substitute for the seas. You know, this is a crisis in which even economics meets its limits. And that's why some scientists recently have proposed in Society and Ecology, actually Jim Hansen, the famous NASA scientist, Bill Stephen from ANU, who is a climate scientist, they've actually proposed, again, it comes back to politics, interesting politics, but utopian. They've proposed that all the governments come together and make certain compact. And they've named 7 thresholds, like the planet's temperature, the oceans, acidification, that there will be 7 thresholds which human beings will not cross, whatever socioeconomic choices they make. So what I'm saying is that there is this kind of image of a supplementary kind of politics that's always bubbling up with this crisis. And the scientists are turning to questions of humanities, questions of rhetoric, questions of creativity, to find new prophets, new kind of imaginations, which will give shape to this supplementary politics. And in some ways, it seems to me that the question of the supplementary politics is perhaps the most silent question in the politics of climate change as it is structured today. Thank you very much.